We continue on in our chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through the New Testament. We begin 1 Corinthians chapter 10 this morning, where Paul is building on his recent spiritual metaphor of running well and finishing strong. Now, he closed out that metaphor by mentioning something about the disqualification of being disqualified from eternal rewards. And don't forget that all of this sits within the context of abusing our Christian liberties and our Christian rights. He's going to bring that all right back to us when we get to verse 23, just so that we don't forget. That's still his major theme here. But because Paul has put that to the side for a little while, we're going to do the same thing for this morning, perhaps even for next week as well. We're going to put the topic of Christian liberties and Christian rights to the side. And we want to just take a look at what Paul's talking about literally and specifically here in the verses that we'll take. We'll come back to the context. We'll let the Apostle Paul wrap that all up, bring it all together, tie a nice bow around it, and finish it up for us once we hit verse 23. But for today, we will first take a look at some of the things that served, according to Paul, as unifiers for the folks that Paul is going to give to us as examples. And that is going to be in verses 1 through 4. And then after that, Paul is then going to give us a list of the disqualifiers, the things that disqualified the folks that he's giving us as examples from their rewards. Okay, so that's going to be verses 5 through 10. So verses 1 through 4, unifiers. Verses 5 through 10, disqualifiers. Now for them, the Lord is going to choose to inspire the Apostle Paul to give us the nation of Israel as his example. And for them, the reward that is being discussed is the reward of getting to enter into the promised land. So that's what Paul is kind of comparing with us, the church. Their reward would be making it to and entering into the promised land. And that should be as far as we are willing to take that text. I do not believe that Paul was trying to declare to us that all of the folks listed out here in these examples were eternally damned because of the sins that they committed and the punishments from God that were meted out upon them. I don't think Paul is meaning to make those arguments at all here in these stories, in these examples. I don't believe anyone, any man, apart from the righteous judge himself, can make those kind of judgment calls. Well, that person went to heaven and that person went to hell. That is above our pay grade. That is the Lord's work as the righteous judge and not ours. So I don't think that's what Paul's doing at all. I think what he is doing is contrasting the Christian life, right? That's running the race. That's the metaphor. The Christian life, finishing well, getting your reward, making sure that nothing you've done disqualifies you from getting that reward, not the reward of eternal life, but the individual rewards that come for our good works. So the rewards on top of eternal life. And the comparison that he's giving us is the nation of Israel. Running their race would be making it from Egyptian bondage to the promised land. Should have taken them about 11 days. Took them a little bit longer than that. It took them around 40 years. But that was their race. And then when they are dropped off finally on the doorstep of the promised land, the question is, did any of those folks in that first generation of the nation of Israel do anything to disqualify them from claiming their reward of entering into the promised land? Now, if you're a studied Bible student, you know the answer to that question, but Paul's going to break it down for us, so let's let him do that. We begin reading at verse 1. Paul says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers," and I know this isn't a good sign, but let's stop right there real quick, because that is a statement and a half. When you consider that Paul is writing this to a predominantly Gentile church. Paul is a Jew, born of the seed of Benjamin, of the tribe of Benjamin. He is a Jew, a Pharisee of the Pharisees. And yet in writing to the Gentile church, what does he do? He gives them the credit or the right to claim the Jewish heritage as their heritage. I love that about Paul. He was not greedy with the Jewish heritage. He did not look down on Gentiles and say, well, sorry, it's just not in your blood. I'm a Jew. You're a pagan. Paul never did that. He was always all about sharing that Jewish heritage with Gentile believers that came to Christ. And we studied that together in the book of Romans, and perhaps you remember Paul teaching us that, that once you are a believer in Jesus the Messiah, once you've been washed by the blood, you have now been adopted into the family. That Christ's blood, that is the bloodline. That's the one that matters. Not only the Jewish bloodline, the blood of Christ. That's the bloodline that really matters. You're saved now. So the patriarchs, you have a claim to them. You remember Paul teaching us that? You can call Abraham your father. You're a Gentile, not a Jew. But you can call Abraham your father, because before this was ever about bloodline, what was it about first? Faith. Faith. Abraham was justified by his faith. God called him out of Ur, and Abraham obeyed, not knowing where he was going, but trusting in God. So he's credited as being the father of faith. So if you have the faith of Abraham, which is trust in God, faith in him, then you get to call yourself a son or a daughter of Abraham. You get to be included in that spiritual lineage. Reading on in verse 1. Brothers, don't want you to be unaware of this fact. I want to make sure you know this, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses, verse 2, in the cloud and in the sea. Now that sets the parameters for the examples that Paul is going to use. I already shared with you, that's first gen Israel, the first generation of the nation of Israel. He's just given us those parameters. These are the folks that were under the cloud, and these are the folks who passed through the sea. That is first generation Israel only. So every story he's going to give you, you know where it's coming from. It's coming from their story. The cloud here refers to the visible manifestation of the glory of God, the Shekinah, the pillar of cloud in the Old Testament, that led first gen Israel out of Egyptian bondage in that Exodus toward the promised land, albeit sometimes in circles in their desert wanderings, and ultimately dropping them off on the doorstep of the promised land. So point number one would be this. Point number one, they were all led exactly the same way. This is important, okay? Paul is establishing commonality. He's going to get the divergence, but he's showing us commonality first. That entire first generation of Israel, they were all led exactly the same way. And Paul says that all passed through the sea. Obviously, that's referring to first gen Israel crossing over the Red Sea on dry ground, walking between the walls of water. They all did that. All of them. None of them boated across. None of them walked the long way around. None of them helicoptered over to the other side. They all walked the same pathway. So point number one was what? They were all led exactly the same way. Point number two would be they all covered the exact same ground. Or if you prefer, they all had the exact same experiences. Commonality. In their mutual journey of faith with the Lord, according to Paul, he now says they were baptized into Moses. Now that is not speaking about a religious ritual. Don't think of it like, you know, I baptize you in the name of Moses and of Aaron and of the Holy Tabernacle. Dunk. No, this is not like water baptism. It's not a ritual. Paul's using the word baptism in a very general way. And the word baptism itself only means to be identified with. That's all that word means. We think baptism means being dunked. That's not really what it means. Baptism means to be identified with. So when we are baptized in water for Christ or to Christ, we're saying in that moment, I am identifying with Christ. That's why we as the Christian church exercise that right, R-I-T-E, as a way to let a person make their public declaration of faith in Jesus. That's the moment of identification with Christ. That's how Paul is using this. So point number one, they were all led exactly the same way. Point number two, they all covered the exact same ground, or they all had the exact same experiences. And point number three, they all identified with the same leader. So there's commonalities. You can see what Paul's doing, right? He's making this comparison with the New Testament church. We can say the same thing about the church in all three of these things, right? We're all led exactly the same way. We all cover the same ground spiritually, and we all identify with the same leader. These are our commonalities. Now, what Paul is going to do, as I stated, is from these commonalities, show us where the divergences came. Some went on to win their rewards, and some went on to find out that they were disqualified from those rewards. That's where all of this is going. The clearest Old Testament example of this, you know, being in exactly the same situation and yet diverging in the pathway that you take in life would be, of course, from the story of Jacob and Esau, and Esau. Jacob and Esau. They were twins. They shared the same womb together, and yet one came out smooth and the other came out hairy. One was smooth in his relationship with the Lord, and the other one turned into a dirty hairy, basically. Right? One came out loving the Lord, the other one came out with absolutely no kind of spiritual inclinations, absolutely no kind of interest in the Lord or the birthright of the nation of Israel. So that's a great example for us of, and I share these kind of things with you all the time, like you two unbelievers can be sitting right next to each other in a church service, and when they leave, the one is touched and brought, and they repent, and they get saved, and the other one leaves and is like, well, that was weird. Totally creeped out right now. The songs were dumb. The pastor was stupid. You know, two very different results can happen in the exact same situation. That, of course, can happen for believers as well. You know, two believers, one on one side, one on the other side, and one leaves just completely blessed and edified and lifted up, and the other one is bored out of their mind, feeling dry, wondering why the song leader sang that same song today that they sang a couple weeks ago, and wondering why the pastor repeated himself so much and was boring and fumbled over his words. They sang the same songs, they heard the same things, the same teaching, everything that they went through in that sanctuary experience was the same, and yet two very different results. Here's more unifiers, all right? So those are the things that unify. Here's some more unifiers, verse 3. It says, and all ate the same spiritual food. And that, of course, would be referring to the miracle manna. It was physical food, yes. But as Paul states, it was spiritual food as well, in the fact that it was supernaturally provided by the Lord. It had to be. That manna was not naturally occurring. So even though God produced physical food for them, Paul calls it spiritual food because it took a miracle daily, you know, daily miracles to produce manna for them. It's kind of hilarious to listen to the skeptics to try to explain this away. Like, well, it wasn't really manna. Look, those people in the, you know, in that, you know, that first generation, they're just not all that bright. And it was just sap from the trees there in the desert. And it was dried, and they thought it was some kind of miracle food. Well, if you just look at the sheer volume of food that would be needed to feed approximately 2.5 to 3 million people in the desert, not in the lush gardens, in the desert, then you realize it had to be a miracle. There's no tree that could produce that much sap, not in the desert. There's no kind of food source that could be mistaken for miracle manna. This was 4,500 tons of manna that would need to be given daily to 3 million people. That's 9,000 tons on the sixth day of the week. Because remember, on the sixth day of the week, they had to collect twice as much because they couldn't gather on the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week. So you're talking tons and tons of food. If you add that up over the course of a year, that's 1.6 million tons of miracle manna every year for 40 years. Major miracle. I'd say that's spiritual food. And then Paul says in verse 4, and all drank the same spiritual drink. And of course, that would be referring to those miraculous moments where the Lord supernaturally caused the rock to gush forth water. Multiple occasions that happen, right? And again, what made that spiritual? It was just water that was produced, right? Yes. But again, that's stuff that was not naturally occurring. They are in the desert. They are in dry places. They get to the point where they pray, Lord, we need a miracle. We need water. You know, you can go a while without food. But in the desert without water, you've got probably 2 days max, 3 days, if you're very lucky, very fortunate. So these were prayers for miracles, and from dry places multiple times in their story, the Lord caused water to come forth from a rock. And again, think about the sheer volume of this. This would need to be water that could water successfully to satiation 3 million people. So that's, you just figure a gallon a day. Each person gets a gallon a day. You know, maybe drink a half a gallon a day, save the rest up for a weekend bath. I don't know, but each person gets a gallon a day. If you just calculate those numbers, that's 3 million gallons of water per day that had to gush out of that rock. This is no little spring. That's over 1 billion gallons for each year over the course of 40 years. We're talking major miracles here. Yes, spiritual bread, spiritual water. Reading on in verse 4, he says, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. That's a head scratcher, right? You ever have a rock follow you? I didn't think so. Well, Paul is not suggesting that this one rock was literally following them around in the desert. You know, like Aaron saying to Moses, Moses, don't look now. The rock's back. I thought we lost it on that last corner, but there it is again. It's catching up on us. Should we run? It's not like that. This was not literally following them around. What Paul means to do here is be poetic and, more importantly, theological. He's meaning to be poetic and theological. He's giving us a spiritual interpretation of what actually took place. No, the rock didn't literally follow them around, which would be really cool, but it's just that every time they needed God to provide water, they asked, the Lord provided. There was a rock, different rocks, no doubt, but there was a rock that the Lord split open and then gushed forth from it water to satiate all of the people of Israel. And so for that reason, Paul sees a spiritual type in this. It's pretty obvious, right? But he goes on to say it like this in verse 4. And the rock, you know, that rock that followed them around everywhere, that spiritual rock, that rock was Christ. So Paul believes that that rock that produced supernatural water in the desert for those wandering Hebrews represented Christ in the New Testament. And it's because Paul made that connection for us that we can finally look back to the story of Moses and understand why Moses was treated so harshly when he didn't do exactly what the Lord said with the rock the second time. If you know the story, you know how this went. The first time that the nation of Israel was in dire need of water and called out to the Lord, Moses prayed, and the Lord spoke to Moses and said to Moses, strike the rock, smite the rock with your rod. And so Moses did that. The rock split and gushed forth water. But the second time this happened, the Lord didn't say, all right, Moses, strike the rock again. Instead, the Lord said, Moses, speak to the rock this time. And what happened? Well, by the time Moses got out there to speak to the rock to bring forth water, the people were complaining more and more. They were griping. They were mumbling. They were groaning. And it frustrated Moses. Moses, the meekest man on the face of the earth, let those people bend him out of shape. Once again, he got angry And in anger, instead of speaking to the rock this time, he struck it again. And the consequences of doing so was that the Lord would not allow him to enter into the promised land then. And we say, well, that's pretty severe. But listen, it was a pretty big mistake from Moses. First of all, Moses was the one that was angry at the people, not God. God provided for them. In God's mercy and grace, he understood the mankind that we are dust. He knows our frame. And in his mercy, he was providing. Moses was the one that was angry. Therefore, Moses misrepresented God to the people. He made God seem like he was angry at the people when God wasn't. But then second of all, and this is what we get from reading Paul's New Testament take on this, the reason why God acted so severely with Moses in his punishment is because right here, the rock was Christ. That was to serve as a typology for Jesus. And Moses, by failing to do what the Lord said, instead of speaking to the rock but striking it the second time, had wrecked the typology. He had ruined the typology. If you just look at that really quickly, it's very obvious how the Lord meant it. He meant this to be a typology for salvation. First of all, the rock, Jesus, was smitten once to produce living water, salvation, the Holy Spirit for all of mankind. But he only had to be smitten one time. And then from that point on, as Paul would say in the book of Romans, chapter 10, verses 8 through 10, the word is near you, even in your mouth. That is, the rock has been smitten, as the book of Hebrews would say, once and for all. The book of Hebrews says that at least four different times. Christ's sacrifice was once and for all. The rock, Christ, was smitten. And after being smitten once for all, then salvation is as close to us as the words on our lips. From that point forward, all we have to do is speak to the rock that was already smitten for our refreshment, for our living water, for our salvation. So that was the typology. That's what Moses wrecked. That's why it was such a serious thing. Paul made that connection for us. Well, now Paul is done with the unifiers, the things that all of these folks in first gen Israel had in common. And now what he wants to do is give us the divergence and list out the disqualifiers. He wants to list out for us the things that were disqualifiers for first gen Israel, keeping them from entering the promised land. And he wants you to know that these are also disqualifiers for you as the Christian, if you desire to run your Christian race well and get rewards for all of your works in the end. Wouldn't it be a shame to do all of these Christian works and to do it really well, but then get to the end and find out that there were all of these disqualifiers in your life, and so you lose all of those additional rewards that you would have gained otherwise? Paul wants to help you. He wants to assist you and try to keep you from that. So verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, with the majority of the first generation of the nation of Israel, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness or the desert. So that's quite an understatement, is it? Isn't it? Pardon me. You know, of the 2.5 to 3 million Jews that made their exodus out of Egypt, only two men made it into the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. We assume that means their spouses as well, if they were married. If they had kids, their kids definitely got in, because the entire second generation of the nation of Israel got in. This was like one of the rare moments of history where the second generation turned out better than their parents. That almost never happens. I'd say in America, the opposite is happening right now. The former generations, you can just watch them. Well, that one's pretty good. Yeah, a little worse. Yeah. That's Arlen's generation. That one's worse. And you just keep going, and you just get to the point where you're like, oh man, we need a restart. But for everyone else in that first generation, the wilderness, the desert, that was their graveyard. That was where they died. They never set foot in the promised land. And Paul now gives us five different sins that caused the disqualification of the overwhelming majority of first-gen Israel, right? And here's verse 6, the first one. Verse 6, now these things took place as examples for us that we might not desire or lust after evil as they did. Now, Paul would likely have Numbers chapter 11 in mind here. You can write that down. This is the story of Israel lusting after meat. Unless you think that was just an innocent craving, understand that God saw that as an evil thing. First of all, their desire for meat was stronger than their desire for God's deliverance, because they got to the point where they were like, you know what? I would rather just go back to Egypt and sit by the flesh pots. I would rather have meat than God's deliverance. I miss the leeks and the onions. I miss all of the food we had as miserable slaves in Egypt. I regret ever leaving. I regret ever being delivered by God. So God saw that as a major act of rebellion against him, as a discredit and an ingratitude toward his salvation in their lives. And Paul upholds the fact here that this was a major evil that they lusted after. Isn't that amazing? Something as harmless as meat, craving meat. Something as harmless as that can turn into a great evil for you, depending on how far you're willing to go to satisfy that craving. It's kind of scary. It's important that we learn these lessons and we don't repeat their disqualifying behaviors. That's the point of this, all right? I love a story that Calvary Chapel Philly pastor Joe Foch tells. It's a story about just a wonderful dog. Listening to the story, I think it must have been a border collie. But he had this wonderful dog, perfect in every way except for one thing. That dog loved to kill chickens. And this guy was a farmer, so that was a problem. Instead of getting rid of the dog, he decided to try to teach the dog a lesson. So what he did was he waited until the next time that dog went into the coop and killed another chicken. And he took and tied that dead chicken around that dog's neck. And he left it there for a month. I assume he wasn't allowed in the house during the space of that month. When that month was over, he took the dead chicken off that dog's neck. Mysteriously, that dog was forever cured of wanting to go anywhere near a chicken. And that's what these stories are supposed to do for us. What I'm saying here is read those Old Testament stories a lot. Tie those chickens to your neck. Let their stories, their disqualifications, their punishments teach you and warn you about the purity of your spirituality in your Christianity. This is what Paul's giving us here as examples and advantages to us in our walks with the Lord. Very important that we take this seriously. So disqualifier number one, lust for evil or desire for evil. Verse 7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And that would be in reference to the infamous golden calf incident there at the foot of Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 32. Their pastor Moses was up on the mountaintop of Mount Sinai receiving the Ten Commandments from the Lord. He was up there for 40 days. You know the story. The people started to wonder, is that guy even alive? He is up there in age, and the Lord's been running him up and down that mountain. He might not still be alive. So, Aaron, assistant pastor, we need to move on. Can you make us new gods? And so Aaron took all of their gold, and he melted that down and formed a new god, a golden calf. I don't know if it was a new god or an old one that they were familiar with from Egypt, but they make this new god. And Joshua is up there with Moses, and Joshua says, what's that? I think I hear something. Is that the sound of war? Is there a battle taking? Are our people getting attacked? Sounds like dying cats down there. And Moses said, no, it's not the sound of war. That's the sound of singing. They're worshiping. But you know what? Weird. Those don't sound like our hymnals. Those don't sound like our church songs. Something's off. And so Moses had to cut his time short with the Lord, and he and Joshua descended the mountain. By the time Moses got down the mountain and to the foot where the encampment of Israel was, he found them dancing naked around a golden cow, having an orgy. And these expressions here of sitting down to eat and drink, that's speaking of gluttony in party scenarios, celebrations. They were worshiping this false god. When it speaks of rising up to play, that is referring to sensual, sexual, sinful play. So Moses finds them in horrible condition, and the Lord has to judge them for that. So disqualifier number two, pardon me, is, of course, idolatry. It's worshiping any created thing, which is one and the same as worshiping anything or anyone but God himself, because everything else is created. God is the only uncreated eternal being. So disqualifier number two, idolatry. Verse 8, we must not indulge in sexual immorality. You knew this one was coming, didn't you? This is always high on the Lord's list of harmful sins. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day. Now, this is from Numbers chapter 25, and that was the fallout from the story that we read of Balaam and Balak in Numbers chapters 22 through 24. Balak had hired Balaam to curse the nation of Israel. Again, you probably know the story. He was incapable of doing so. He tried three times to curse the nation of Israel. Every time Balaam opened his mouth, the Lord filled it with blessing for Israel instead. And he got to the point where this guy that was paying him to curse Israel was pressuring him. And he said, look, I'm just going to be honest with you. My own paraphrase here. I can't curse them. In fact, no one can. No one can curse what God has blessed. God blessed this people. And you can't curse them from without. But I can tell you how you can make it so that they curse themselves from within. So I'll tell you exactly what you need to do to get them to rebel against their God, force the hand of their God to punish them, and therefore cause their fall. And so his solution was, all you have to do is gussy up your Moabite women. Send them out there winking and flirting, and before long, the men in the nation of Israel, they're going to be sleeping with those Moabite women, and that will bring the Lord's judgment on their encampment. And sure enough, that worked. That's the story here. So 23,000 people died in one day, according to the Apostle Paul. If you read that from the book of Numbers, it says that 24,000 people died. Is that an inconsistency? What's the right number, 23,000 or 24,000? Well, anytime we're given differing information within the Bible, we don't consider it inconsistencies. We just take it as different bits of information. We put it all together, and it gives us a more complete journal of what took place. So in compiling both of those numbers, here's the truth that we get out of that. 23,000 people died in the first day, according to Paul. Total number, 24,000, the book of Numbers. That means that about 1,000 other people died as the next day came and went. So 24,000 people total died because of sexual immorality. So disqualifier number three is sexual immorality or sexual sin. Verse 9, we must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. This is the story from Numbers chapter 21. Verses 4 through 9, and this story could easily be about grumbling and complaining, because that's what they were doing when the Lord decided to send them venomous snakes to bite them and begin to kill off people within the nation, you know, the grumblers and the complainers. But Paul reserves the topic of grumbling and complaining for his next example. Instead, what he wants to use here is the fact that in their grumbling and complaining, they tested God. Let me put that another way. They really pushed God to the limits of his patience. They really pushed God's buttons here with their complaining. And so the story goes that God sent these venomous snakes. They were biting some of the folks there in the nation of Israel. people were starting to die, they called out to Moses for help. Moses turned to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, make yourself a bronze serpent, stick it on a pole, raise the pole, and anyone that looks at the serpent will be saved. And I feel bad for the people that said, that's stupid. How is looking at a serpent on a pole going to help me in any way? I've been bit by a venomous snake. But the point in that was another typology for Christ. And Jesus used this himself. As the serpent was lifted up on the pole in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. The typology is not that Christ is the serpent that you raise up on the pole. But the point is that when you look at the cross by eyes of faith for us in this generation and see the Christ on the cross, if you can by faith see your sin, your serpent, the thing that's biting you and killing you, if you can see your sin hanging on that cross, being killed on that cross for you, then that's salvation. That's the message. But disqualifier number four would be putting Christ to the test or pushing the limits of God's patience. Verse 10, and we'll finish up with this verse because we're running out of time here. Okay, just be honest, it's already gone. But verse 10, it says, nor grumble, don't murmur and complain, don't whine and gripe, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. So Paul's reference here is Numbers chapter 16, verses 41 through 50. This was the incident with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Now, largely that was Korah. He had started this rebellion mainly against the leadership of Moses, but also indirectly against the leadership of Aaron. And these other guys joined along with him. They were all part of the family, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. They had attempted this coup against God-given leadership. So Moses had them all bring their censers forward, and they were going to have a little prayer competition based on these censers to see who the Lord would approve of and who the Lord would disqualify. So they all came with their censers, and long story short, Aaron was fine, and the rest of them were censored. Yes, censers, and they were censored. Okay, you're just ready to go then? Okay. So it's the best kind of censorship. The Lord knew whose voice needed censored. And that, I'm all for free speech to a certain point. But if we're being honest, free speech is an American ideal. It's not a biblical thing. And you see in cases like this where there are times where it would just be best if we didn't have to listen to certain voices. Do you agree? God's okay with censorship if those voices are evil and they are harming us and corrupting us and destroying us. So the Lord censored them. And after that rebellion occurred, and this is really where the story takes the turn, more people, you would think, you know, when the Lord censors the voices that need censored, that's it, problem solved. Story over, but the real problem came afterward when congregants came to Moses and once again grumbled and griped and complained and whined and said, Moses, you're getting God's people killed. What are you doing? You're like the worst pastor ever. Again, my words in a paraphrase. Moses, you're getting our people killed. And they started to gripe against Moses even more. Poor Moses couldn't win for losing. And that angered the Lord. And so the Lord sent the Lord sent the destroyer, aka a plague, through the camp, and 14,700 people lost their lives. So disqualifier number five is grumbling and complaining, murmuring and whining. Now, I'll end with this note. You know how serious the Bible is about mumbling, about complaining. We often do not treat this as a sin. We treat it as just an acceptable part of human nature, but it is a sin when we complain. The Lord, He really dislikes that. If you don't know that, you need to read back through the desert wandering years very carefully once again. The Lord does not like complaining. And I think the main reason he does not like it is because the things you are unhappy about, the things that you are discontent about, all you have to do with them, instead of gossiping about them with friends and family and church folk, is bring them to him and talk them over with him. And you know what he'll do? He'll either change the situations you're complaining about, or he'll change the heart of the complainer. And he'll show you all the things for which you ought to be content.